Hello and welcome to the Biden Taxes Building Your Dreams episode of Intrigue Explained. I'm John Fowler, co-founder of International Intrigue, the only daily briefing written by former diplomats. Again, after a one-week hiatus, I've got Dmitry Grozbinski here with me, the founder and director of Explain Trade, a trade consultancy based in Geneva. Dmitry, how was your week off and how are you this week?
I had a lovely week off. I went to northeastern France and generally reveled in the perfection of the French wine countryside. So I am back refreshed, still mildly hungover.
Hungover? I was going to say.
Well, listen, it's a fine wine hangover. It's basically a cathartic experience.
A mild inconvenience rather Indeed. Than like a devastating inconvenience to your day.
Mostly an inconvenience to the people around me as I sulk relentlessly.
Twas ever thus.
Indeed.
On the other line here, we've got Helen, my co-founder, of course, at International Intrigue. Helen in DC, how are we today?
I'm well, John. You've caught me in DC, although I'm about to head off tomorrow to Qatar. So more on that later on. Lots to discuss.
Let's not talk about your climate footprint because then that would force me to talk about mine and we'd all be coming off looking pretty bad. All right, well, let's dive into it this week. We've got a main topic we've decided to talk about is Biden's new, I say Biden, America's, but instituted by President Biden, his new tariffs, taxes, import restrictions. We'll dive into what precisely to call them on Chinese EVs and a bunch of other stuff. We decided this topic because obviously, as long-term listeners will know, Dmitry is a trade expert. We'll do our best to kind of keep him talking at a normie level because both Helen and I are very, very much normies when it comes to trade. But I think it's a good chance to actually figure out what's going on rather than just relying on headlines from folks who, just like Helen and I, don't really understand what's going on.
Exactly.
So we'll dive into that. But first, I think we wanted to just do a quick kind of update and reflections on what's going on in the Ukraine war. There's been kind of this steady drumbeat or you know, drip, drip, drip of news over the last, let's call it, couple of weeks of Russia's position kind of improving, particularly in the northeast around Kharkiv. That being essentially that Russia's making advances militarily and Ukraine feels like it's militarily unable to respond or having trouble responding. The context here, obviously, is that the US bill to support Ukraine with military aid passed a few weeks ago through Congress. That was a 6-month longer process that took the political life of the former speaker. So we've got this context of like a bunch of different stuff's happened. We haven't talked about it for a while. We haven't written about it in the newsletter for a while. So I thought it was a good chance to just kind of take stock. Dmitry, why don't you kind of guide us through maybe the change in the military position over the last, let's call it month, 2 months, something like that.
Sure. With usual caveats about my not being a military expert. So this is repeating.
It's never stopped us before.
Indeed, in any context, on any subject, is our modus operandi. So Russia has accelerated its attempts to push Ukraine after the passage of the US bill. There was a sense that there was a window was closing during which the US had authorized transfers but hadn't actually made them yet. There's a sense that Russia is attempting to basically overstretch an already overstretched Ukrainian army by just launching offensives and applying pressure across a full 1,000-kilometer front. So they attack here and they attack there and they attack there, and their goal is to deplete Ukrainian forces. A big part of that was they amassed 50,000 troops, allegedly, north of Kharkiv. So Kharkiv is for those who don't know, it is quite a large city in Ukraine. It is 30 kilometers from the Russian border.
I think maybe Lviv's the second biggest, right? It's a big city.
It's a bit smaller now after the evacuations, but yes, it's a very large city. It's a city I was born in, incidentally. But it's 30 kilometers from the Russian border. And it had been like partially encircled when the war began. And then in the successful Ukrainian counteroffensive, not the one late last year, but the first one, they kind of pushed the Russians back across the border around it. And now the Russians are pushing back the other way. Initially, it felt like the Russian goal was to encircle the city, make huge amounts of progress. They have been bogged down. They have basically taken about 4 or 5 villages. They've claimed about, I think it was like 30 square kilometers, maybe like 50 square kilometers of Ukrainian territory. And everything's bogged back down into positional attritional warfare.
What does that mean when you say bogged down? Is this like, because at one point it was like physically actually bogged down because of the warming spring, right? Is that what you mean there, Dim? Or what do you mean by bogged down?
So in this case, no, there is a phenomenon in Ukraine where everything turns to mud, but this isn't what's happening in this case. In this case, it's basically like they're just not able to advance as fast as they'd like. They got to the kind of outskirts of, I think it's Voshansk, and they're sort of in the northern suburbs and just the front stopped moving that quickly. And this is kind of something that I think it'd be interesting to talk about with you both about, is that there's a longstanding Ukrainian critique that happened where they basically said, we watched the Russians amass 50,000 troops on the Russian side of the border, and we weren't able to hit them with US supplied weaponry because that crosses the US red line. And so they're basically like, the Russians were able to like parade ground, assemble themselves 30 kilometers away from us or however what distance, and then just kind of drive in without us being able to do anything. I'd sort of be curious on how fair you think that is. What's the thinking and so on?
I mean, again, I think it's interesting when you kind of look back on when we've been covering this for 2 years, you've been reading about it for 2 years. So you kind of can build a timeline of narrative developments of how this war has played out in your head. And I think it's the classic example of if you knew what you know now, then I would argue that the policy was, you know, arguably too restrictive. The big thing hanging over this, of course, is like Russia has nuclear weapons and Putin knows how to use that as a strategic game theory threat. And it's credible. It is credible because he controls everything. There's no real credible sense that anyone in his regime would prevent him from firing nuclear weapons. So that's the point of nuclear weapons, is that these restrictions come from the credible threat of having a nuclear weapon. So I think it's so hard because you say, oh, but he hasn't used them, therefore we could have gone further. But how much further? So I don't know. I think it's a very reasonable thing to say, we will support you, don't use it on Russian territory. Another wrinkle is when that promise was given, the US support was fairly ironclad. We've since learned that there's been a lot of problems in that ironclad support. So, you know, Ukraine, I don't know. I tend to say that I would have made the same decision if I was in the US and arguing to supply Ukraine with military weapons, but you can argue either way. Helen, do you have a view?
Yeah, I mean, I think Ukraine needs now stand on its own two feet in some ways, right? Because they've learned that they can't rely on the US to come through with the money as well as the weaponry sometimes. So they need to quickly, I think the way forward is that they need to quickly develop their own indigenous capabilities to produce weapons.
But that's not going to happen anytime soon, right?
That's kind of like where I think they need to go if we actually see this, you know, end of year being this time frame where they can actually still win the war.
Though what's interesting is that in the last 2 days, Ukraine has hit Russia incredibly hard. They've spent years degrading. They've spent the last 2 years degrading Russian anti-air capability by just systematically taking out anti-air sites. And last night they hit Novorossiysk with 80 drones.
Wow.
There's, horrifying from a futurology standpoint kind of video of just drone after drone after drone. And these are the size of small propeller planes. Yeah. Like these are Cessnas flying over and they're just like one after the other and just slamming into an oil refinery in Novorossiysk.
Before we pivot to our main story, I kind of want to take this little conversation in two directions. One is a little bit of a kind of putting my cards on the table. And it's, if I were an American taxpayer, like what you just described, Dimitri, is just the most compelling argument about why the US should still be supplying Ukraine with weapons. It's if you believe Russia is a strategic adversary, which I certainly do, I appreciate that some portion of the population doesn't believe that. But if you do, my God, what a way to like degrade an enemy, you know, provide weapons to Ukraine. They do the work of taking out oil refineries, airports, all this kind of stuff. So
drones are relatively cheap as well in comparison, right?
Oh, cents on the dollar, cents on the dollar.
Aircraft carrier, et cetera.
And politically free, almost free, because you're not losing any American lives. I mean, we're talking very callously about all this kind of stuff, which I trust our audience to kind of interpret that in the way that we intend it. So that's the first point. Mitch McConnell's made that point a ton of times, right? Like, this is an opportunity. But the second thing I wanted to kind of just, I was out in the West Coast last week and I had a chance to visit Anduril, the headquarters of
awesome.
a, Yeah, it was a fascinating experience. So for those folks who don't know, Anduril is a defense company, a tech company, a startup really, not a startup anymore, but it was founded only 7 years ago by the guy who invented and sold the Oculus VR company. He founded that and sold it to Facebook and then worked at Facebook for a while, or Meta as it is now. He's a character and I'm not going to weigh into that, but the company he's built is remarkable. In 7 years, they've become a legit defense contractor. But Dimitri, when you were saying these kind of 80 drones attacking Russian targets, it reminded me of that, because one of the biggest things that Anduril is developing is like, in the same way that SpaceX has developed reusable rockets, they're developing reusable anti-drone munitions. So the idea that if Russia sent 80 drones to America, America can, because one of the big things about Iran developing these drones, it's really, really cheap to just send 80 drones to destroy a place, and it's not feasible to defend it with missiles because missiles cost $1.2 million or 20 or whatever they cost. And they were developing these loitering munitions. You can launch them. If the drone isn't there, they come back and they're reusable. If the drone is there, they just basically run into the drone and like don't even explode often, just knock it down like a slap. So I just found that an interesting context of what you were saying. And
did you see the Dutch police eagle?
No.
The Dutch police have been training eagles to catch drones. They can convince them that drones are prey, and they have trained these eagles to fly. They've piloted this now, and they've got a really high, they've got like a 75% catch rate, where they just fly up, grab this thing, and fly it to a safe zone. Because the eagle is so much stronger than a drone. Like it just,
it probably doesn't work if you have like 100 drones, but it's a great particularly police measure of like.
I mean, poor eagles. I feel like you're just expecting like PETA or some animal advocacy organizations come in and talk about their torn up talons, you know?
Wouldn't that be a microcosm of our modern world? Like we've developed this incredibly effective anti-drone technique. Sorry, it's animal cruelty and it's illegal.
Yes, correct. Yeah. what a great little snippet.
But more seriously, I just found it very, to the point that you were talking about that with eagles, they were like, oh, we trialed having drones throw nets over other drones, but we just found out that it wasn't accurate enough. So we just were like, why complicate things? Make cheap drones and bash into other stuff. And I was like, huh.
Modern warfare is simultaneously terrifying and basically a cartoon.
Like, I know.
Yeah.
Like we're 10 minutes away from giant hammers on an arm, like flying up there and just bonking drones out of the sky.
I'm here for it.
I have to say, if you ever get a chance to go and check out these like defense tech AI expos, et cetera, it's such a novelty to go and see it. I mean, obviously taking aside the fact that warfare, et cetera, is awful, but the capabilities that these like minute sort of sophisticated technologies can do these days in urban warfare is really quite incredible. And I don't think it's something that we've actually seen on like a bigger scale, and, like that's swarms true. And swarms of drones.
As a gamer who's in foreign policy, I can simultaneously hold two ideas in my head, which is that warfare is awful and cool as hell. Like
we ain't seen, yeah.
That's just, I'm capable of holding those two thoughts.
I derailed this conversation a little bit, but Dimitri, I want to give you the last word just before we move on to our main topic. What else is standing out to you about the Ukraine situation? Anything else we need to know? What can we expect in the next couple of months?
So Russia has begun a shakeup of its internal, I think I'm pretty sure Intrigue wrote about this. They've replaced the defense minister Shoigu after forever, who was a close Putin ally and apparently a hard worker, though corrupt as hell. And they have replaced him with a very experienced economist, which has led some in the criminology space to say, this means that Putin is committed to improving the efficiency of the Russian Ministry of Defense and settling in for a long attritional outproduce the West kind of situation. I'm always really cautious when we try to read into that, because that's like a super Western framing of like, they've promoted an economist into the Ministry of Defense. That must mean it could just be like weird internal mafia dynamics where this guy's power is at a point that it like all this kind of stuff you can never.
I want to amplify that. I completely agree with you. I was on a podcast yesterday where we were talking about this topic, and I said there is a theory that makes sense that, you know, Russian supply chains, particularly around high tech chips and other kinds of weaponry, have been massively disrupted by sanctions and Russia being isolated. And if you were of a mind talking about Anduril, looking at America's defense tech industry, looking at China's industry and going, holy shit, we need to modernize quickly for the new century of warfare, it makes sense to put an economist in charge to kind of construct those. But also he may just be a supplicant and Putin may have him by the absolute bollocks. And he might be like, do you know what? I'm sick of pushback out of the defense ministry. You're in charge now because I know you'll do what I say, right?
Yeah. This is the same as when we had the episode where you guys were talking about how China makes decisions and you're both like, we've been following this for 10 years and no one knows. Like the same thing with the Kremlin. Like you just don't know what's going on there and you can't assume their decision-making.
Putin might have been in a bad mood.
Yeah.
This is the reality of how the world is run, and it's terrifying to people. And I think it's like in the same way that we tell our stories, ancient stories about gods and weather and stuff, it's like we need to have narratives that things are logical and done for a reason. Because if the reality of Putin woke up with a sore ankle and decided to scream at the person next to him and replace his ministry, that's a terrifying prospect versus, he's doing it for these reasons and we can rationalize that and respond.
Have you seen The Regime on HBO? It's the one with Kate Winslet. It's very
that's
much
the reality.
It taps into that idea, right? Of like, oh, this is how the world.
I love potatoes happens. Now.
Yeah, correct.
Exactly.
I'm told that's how you guys run intrigue, but
I insist
I'm
upon
thinking
it.
Twice, Dim. I'm screaming out for help.
I have created it in my own capricious image. Exactly. All right, let's move on to our main topic. I think we can revisit Ukraine, Russia with a main story in the next couple of weeks too, I think, because it's troublingly fallen off the main pages, which I understand for fatigue reasons, but it's still going on. People are still losing their lives in the horrific amounts. And, you know, maybe the geopolitical implications have sort of settled a little bit, but I still think it's worth touching base and kind of updating on it pretty regularly. But for now, let's move on to our main topic. So I'll do a very, very brief introduction of this to give folks the kind of context, but I want Dim, you to jump in pretty quickly and kind of explain the nuts and bolts. But the basic part of this story is that earlier this week, President Biden signed into law a raft of increased tariffs, which are essentially, let's call them taxes, because everyone will fall asleep if we call them tariffs. And the difference is, there is a difference, obviously, but taxes on Chinese goods being imported into the US, the headline grabbing one of those being electric vehicles. And there's a ton to unpick there, but I want to make sure that we understand too, it wasn't just electric vehicles. It's a ton of different things. Dim will go into that. The general arc of why this is being done is unjustifiable trade practices. Dim will dive into that. But I think more realistically, the political justification of this is it's all things that are vaguely attached to national security, in which they do not want China to dominate and prevent US/Western countries developing indigenous industries. That's the broad, I think, political framing, right, Helen?
With a view to EU, right, as well, which I think Dim can also speak about, because it's sort of the EU was an example of a crap, what not to do.
So many weird dynamics about that. But let me just set up the context here for Dim. I want to kind of give you what the White House has said. So Biden issued these tariffs under what is Section 301 of the US Trade Act, which allows the US to investigate and retaliate against breaches of US trade deals and other, quote, unjustifiable trade shenanigans. He has said, or the Biden administration has said, that China has essentially been forced transferring US tech, stealing it, or as we wrote in today's intrigue, yoinking it, and then giving it to its own companies to flood global markets with cheaper produced goods, because obviously the cost of production in China is far lower or was far lower, which then has the effect of wiping out US companies, Western companies, and their jobs. This has been going on for a decade plus, probably two decades in China. We know this isn't controversial. I want to give it to you, Dim, to explain us the nuts and bolts of what happened, what are the tariffs on what things, what the US is arguing from a trade perspective about whether this is legal. I'm sure you're going to say it's probably not. And then why this is a good thing or a bad thing. So over to you.
Sure. And you know, I swear I wouldn't go too long on this, but we do need to do a tiny bit of history. So in ancient Byzantium, trade.
Feel free to tap out now, listeners.
Yeah, exactly. Come back in at the 5-minute mark.
Skip forward.
Come back. I'm kidding. But the little bit of history is that President Trump introduced a slew of tariffs on a range of Chinese goods, including electric vehicles. The tariff on Chinese electric vehicles added up to 27.5%. And when President Biden came in, he was obviously asked, well, are you going to keep all of these tariffs that you criticized at the time Trump did them? And he said, we are going to review them. And that kicked off a multi-year review process where they kind of looked at all of these tariffs, and this is now what they claim to be the result, what they have found. And their argument is that these tariffs are required to offset Chinese government support for the companies that make this stuff. So, John, you mentioned kind of forced transfer of research and development. For people who don't understand how this works, what China basically does is say to American firms, global firms, you are welcome to manufacture in China and sell to the Chinese people. But in order to do so, you need to have a local Chinese partner with a significant ownership stake. The allegation, which at this point is pretty credible, is that that partner
I'm comfortable going on record as saying this absolutely is true. And I saw multiple instances of companies coming to us or to other foreign ministries going, oh my God, we've just been locked out of our whole system in China. We've lost all our IP and basically we have no business left unless we do what they say. I mean, companies come in and be like, oh, well, we're going to sue in the courts. And I'm like, all right, fill your boots.
Good luck, 20 years later.
You flush good money after bad, really.
Yeah. But the Chinese market was so attractive to be in that even seemingly knowing these risks, companies would go in there. But that's only part of the U.S. concern. If that was the sum total of it, the U.S. wouldn't be like, that affects sectors like maybe electric vehicles a little bit more, but China's doing its own research and development in a lot of this electric vehicle stuff. And then there's sectors like steel where there's not that much R&D involved. What they're concerned about is basically Chinese subsidies, overt, covert, all sorts of things. Basically, the idea that the Chinese government is just flooding these companies with money and directly through kind of guaranteed contracts, through cheap loans that they get through ostensibly private banks. And that allows the Chinese to manufacture. You were talking about like, it's not just that the factors of production in China are cheaper. That would be manageable. The issue is that the Chinese government is taking those low factors of production and then lowering them even further by putting their thumb on the scale.
I mean, to give you an idea, right, the difference there between like a Chinese produced EV is something like $10,000 as a unit, as cost. And then the next cheapest thing in the US is a Hyundai, and that's like $28,000. Right, which is more than 2x what the Chinese EVs cost. So that's a big difference.
And to give some Chinese context on this, like if you think about it, talking about history, let's take China at a point in time, maybe like let's say the late 90s, right? Mm. You're a leader of China, you're faced with an enormous country, an enormous population, and an economy that is underproducing its potential by like, you know, just orders of magnitude. What is your problem? Well, the learning curve to get your economy up to a middle developed economy, which they've been, you know, that's been the goal for a long time. The learning curve, the technology learning curve is your biggest problem. You've got the person power, you've got the low cost of production, you've got the will, you've got the market. You don't have the technology to move down that curve. So, and then famously, I mean, you can go into this, but there's a lot of studies that like in business, you can't really short circuit that learning curve. That's why the US has cut off China from semiconductors, is because if you have to do it indigenously, if you have to learn, you can't skip three steps ahead. Think about like understanding mathematics when you're a kid. You can't go from like addition to algebra just because you're really smart. You've kind of got to build the building blocks. And that's the same with a country's economy moving down the learning curve, unless you can just take that technology from somewhere else that's already developed it and implement it, steal their engineers, steal their so that's the context of how China approaches this. It says, hey, we need to develop this thing. We take the technology, then we move down the learning curve. And then Dimitri's point of lower cost of production, that helps us compete in a fair market. What they're doing or what they've famously done is flood the market with government subsidies to then give their companies market dominance, and then they can raise prices or at least get back to the cost of production. Dimitri, back to you. I just kind of wanted to, that history of China is also important with the history of this conflict between the US and China.
Yeah. And I think Helen was mentioning at the start this sort of EU angle to this. On electric vehicles specifically, the US is looking at what happened to the EU market. And there is this sense that it just got flooded with Chinese electric vehicles. China is very visibly overproducing electric vehicles for its own domestic market in terms of like there's like parking lots full of EVs that no one's using. And so there's a sense that it flooded into Europe, and with sort of the acquiescence of European companies, half of which just partnered and started producing over there, it gained EV dominance. Now, the thing where this gets like political and weird is that between the existing 27% 0.5 tariffs And the fact that in order to be eligible for the IRA benefits, the Inflation Reduction Act, sort of subsidies that the US is providing, you can't be a Chinese car.
You have to be made in America, right?
Yeah, they've got to be made in America. So between those two things, Chinese cars are not present in the US market. You have to overcome something like a $17,000 sort of gap with the pre-100%. So this kind of raising it to 100%, which is a suspiciously round number, in fact, all of these tariffs are suspiciously large, makes it feel like this is less about rebalancing a set of specific subsidy levels and more just about being like, look at me taking action.
I mean, maybe you can talk a little bit more about what else is also banned, right? Because I think that is also interesting. There's 100% taxes, tariffs, whatever you want to talk about in the EVs, but then the sort of kind of goes all the way down to like medical supply chain, like crane lifts and other things that you are required in that, you know, process of getting EVs into a country.
Yeah. So there's like, these things fall into like three-ish categories.
Why don't you run down just some of the things that are there so we have some, at least a couple of facts on this podcast rather than mostly my speculation.
So in terms of the three categories and what's in them, you've got the like car stuff. So this is like electric vehicles, battery parts, lithium ion electric vehicle batteries, and then also lithium ion non-electrical vehicle batteries. But you can sort of think of those as all part of the same bag. Mm-hmm. And then semiconductors, which are obviously relevant to EVs, but also relevant to all high tech. Then the second category is you've got solar cells. There is a sense that China massively, massively over-subsidized its production of solar panels.
And it has done that for a long time. I mean, it did that when I was in China in 2016. It was famously eating Germany's lunch with its tech. Germany had developed
Germany's technology. Yeah.
Exactly. And that's before we even get into the wrinkle of a lot of those solar panels being produced in Xinjiang with arguably slave labor from the Uyghurs. So like there's so many elements of this, but what is again, in my view, I'm happy to be the only one to go on record with this, but like incontrovertible and uncontroversial is that they stole German solar technology and flooded the market with Chinese-produced solar panels. Arguably good for the global renewable industry.
There is an interesting debate that kind of goes, if China wants to absolutely flood the planet with dirt cheap solar panels and electric vehicles, we should let them. And we should celebrate that as like, because everything's on fire.
Right up until they flood it with stuff you disagree with, like weapons and surveillance.
So what is the third thing, Dimsy? You said solar.
So rare earth minerals kind of also fall into that sort of EVs, but also solar panel space. And then finally, there's medical equipment. So specifically, I think face masks and protective equipment are both in there.
Is it fair to say national security is like the bundle, like the bow around all three technologies?
Yes, that's right. It's based on national security, right? Like that's how they sort of have sold it internally.
Which is interesting that they've done that because the US has a completely separate mechanism called Section 232, which authorizes the president to do this kind of thing on national security grounds.
So why do you think he's chosen not to do that? Is it political? Is it just it's laughably not national security? What's your view on that?
I think the argument that he wants to make is that he wants to say that he's putting these barriers in place on a fairness grounds, because then you get into like, it's very hard to justify why solar panel production in China is a national security threat. You can sort of make the case for rare earth minerals and semiconductors, electric vehicles. It already gets bloody dubious.
Well, they're talking about the data of electric vehicles, right? They're computer on wheels. So like they'll have a view of where most Americans are going and how and all that kind of stuff. That's the argument.
This brings us back to TikTok, which we discussed on our previous episode, which is that if you think that Chinese-made electric vehicles are a threat to the US from that data gathering thing, the solution is to ban them or regulate them. It is not to make them X percent more expensive, because that's just like, that's not how we deal with safety.
So it's a political decision then to do it this way, you think?
It's a political decision. The way that they've done it is basically on commercial grounds, but obviously national security is a huge factor too. They're just choosing to go a different route.
I'd love to know, Dim, I mean, you worked at the WTO during your posting, right? Would this be something that would be challenged in the WTO? And like, I know there's countless cases that never actually get tried, or like they have they hand down a sentence, but then nothing actually happens and the countries don't do anything about it. So is this something that's likely to end up in the World Trade Organization?
Yeah, so absolutely. I think China has a long history of challenging this kind of thing at the World Trade Organization. So they will first raise it in a bunch of committees and then potentially launch disputes, probably on the sectors where they feel like the US case about their level of subsidy is weaker. Because the US is going to argue that this is just a rebalancing of what China is doing to them, to the market. So the Chinese are probably going to pick a couple of test cases. The goal will be, to be very clear, the goal will be to embarrass the US.
Yeah.
It will not be out of an assumption that the WTO will order the US to stop doing this and the US will comply. The World Trade Organization does not have an active Supreme Court at the moment. It's what's called the appellate body, does not have a single member on it because of a US blockade, in part to prevent the WTO from ruling exactly this kind of thing illegally.
Exactly.
So working as intended from the White House perspective.
If we imagine that the WTO actually is taken seriously by these countries, China and the US, is it illegal? Is it anti-WTO what the US has done? I mean, obviously a very difficult question, but if you had supreme powers to adjudicate this and enforce your decision, what would you say?
Almost certainly it is a breach of the rules. There is a mechanism under the WTO and a procedure you're supposed to follow if you think that your market is being hurt by excessive subsidies or actionable illegal subsidies abroad.
And flooding your market with cheap products.
Yeah, exactly. They're subsidizing and it's hurting your guys because there's a procedure to follow and you're supposed to very carefully calculate exactly how much damage, how much unfairness is going on and then rebalance it with very precise tariffs. This is very clearly not that.
But that's how they're trying to frame it is what you're saying. So like they are saying, hey, we know this. I mean, if anybody knows what they're talking about, it's obviously not this, but to 99% of the population and the media, we're going to say that's what we're doing. Is that what the rebalancing kind of
but they're vibe? Not. They're not following their own kind of procedure for countervailing duties on subsidies. They're not following the rules to do it. They're just doing it through a mechanism that they have. I would imagine that the US, if it didn't just claim national security, would probably lose a case on at least some of these because this is clearly against the sort of letter and spirit. And the US has been quite overt of just being like, we'd like to have an electric car industry, thanks.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, just so we're clear, in the context of the US domestic car industry, right, you had this sort of, what is it, the GE, the Chevrolets, I think the other third one that's just recently sold. But they had gone, their market share in the US, domestic market share before all of this, had already gone down from like something like 78% down to 30-something percent. Anyway, just as you have more so competition within the domestic car market. So I think in response to this, I think this is also like a political move by Biden, right? Which I don't know if we're going to go into in today's episode, but that is also something that's interesting to observe.
Like you mean in terms of the US election political?
Yeah, exactly. As a sort of...
Yeah, United Auto Workers Union in Michigan, and Michigan happens to be a swing state, right? Like,
yeah,
I mean, it's not
100%.
Nevada and Arizona, it's like not rocket science. And that's how politics works, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Let's talk about Europe. So the US response to China's, let's just say China's threatening EV market and BYD and Chery and some of the others are, I think if we zoom out a little bit, like it's, there's no doubt that that China is producing very high quality products in this space. Like BYD electric cars are widely seen as very good, or at least good enough for mass market.
Well, they overtook the Tesla market in 2023 briefly.
And I was just back in Australia and everything, there were tons of them
everywhere. That's
and
right,
John. They're called Build Your Dreams car, BYD, which I found amusing because you wouldn't catch me dead in Australia driving in a car with Build Your Dreams written across the back of it. But they were everywhere, right?
They were everywhere.
Because they're cheap. And one of the biggest problems with EVs in America, which I would love to buy an EV, but they're 20, 30, 40% more expensive than the gas equivalent. So the US is kind of saying, okay, this is what we're going to do. Political reasons, whatever. We want a car industry. Our response is to throw up the trade barrier walls and do that. Dim, what's been Europe's response? Germany, famously a very, very heavy car manufacturing country, but also France has got a bit of an industry. Italy, obviously, different vibes, but Europe hasn't really done that. They've done something different, right?
No, and everyone's watching them quite closely because there's a sense that now what the US has done has effectively given Europe some cover to take a milder stance. What complicates a lot of this is that some of these cars, so like for example, one of the cars that's produced that's actually sold in the US is the Polestar 2. Polestar is a Swedish company.
Right.
It's just, they just, so a lot of these cars are being produced in partnership with European firms. So Europe is caught in this situation where no matter what it chooses to do, it is going to be annoying one group of stakeholders.
Yeah.
For the US, it's a much more binary choice of just like, well, we're going to shield our guys and we're going to hurt their guys. And like, okay, maybe it bounces back on Tesla that's just gotten access into the, that's just gotten more access into the Chinese market and is partnering with Baidu to like do full self-driving. But yeah, I mean, okay, Tesla doesn't employ that many people. Whereas like in Europe, it's a much more complicated thing. And so far what they've done is they have created the legal instruments to hit back if they should choose to do so.
The EU has created those legal instruments, like as in like a sort of Damocles kind of over these industries. Is that right?
Well, it's more like, so we've been talking about the US instruments of Section 301 and Section 232, which provide the US president the authority to raise tariffs. The EU did not have an equivalent of that.
I didn't know that. That's interesting.
Neither did I.
Not in the, like, not nearly to the same extent anyway. So what they have done is they have created this like anti-coercion instrument, which is their kind of attempt to give themselves a legal framework. It's Europe. So everything has to have a legal framework and a committee structure and probably some nice building in Luxembourg, where they have basically built themselves now a legal framework to potentially hit back. What they haven't necessarily done is actually decided to.
I was going to say, it's very generous that they should telegraph so explicitly precisely where China should start to spy and influence by paying people. Oh, you've just set up a like a coercion office of like trade. We'll help you staff that.
Where can we send a suspicious amount of very attractive Chinese students is the line.
Exactly. I find that very interesting. So can I ask you then, if you were the American president, and the way you framed this and the way it seems to me, and Helen, jump in if I'm wrong about this as well, but it seems like the US has basically just gone, we're going to do what we want to do to respond. The rest of the world can get in line. Is there a way that Biden could have crafted some response to the Chinese problem, I'm using that as kind of inverted commas, that achieved his political goals of developing a domestic industry or whatever it is, while at the same time being better with Europe, like coming up with a coordinated plan to do this? Because right now, I know the Inflation Reduction Act has really pissed off a lot of European countries, right? Because it's put a lot
and
of
Koreans,
European...
right? All the allies.
A lot of allies are pissed off because it's like, this is a giant subsidy for your industry to the detriment of us, where our economies are going to get weaker because of your market being more expensive now. Hey, that's upsetting us. And the alliances or the relationships are weaker than they would have otherwise been. I guess the question I'm asking, was there a way for Biden to thread the needle of responding to China while working with allies and keeping them on side? Or is it just too difficult and they're just like, you know what, forget about it. We'll do what we need to do.
I think this is an election year. So I think in any other year, he probably would have come up with a more calibrated approach. But now I think what he's sending the message is like, our top priority in a triage of things is the US domestic vehicle industry, right? And we're going to do whatever it takes and prop it up. The second thing he's done is like, okay, obviously we're going to disadvantage the allies, but we'll give them a sort of favored slightly treatment, right? And then the third is like, okay, well, by sending such a blunt 100% tariff rate to China, it's very clear that we are not letting them in the door, right? So it's at least kind of sending, I don't know, I don't think that he could have done it any differently this year in a way that was a very clear electoral message to constituents who are worried about their jobs and worried about how the world is looking.
I think that's right. I think that there's a couple of like additional little elements. The US and Europe have been negotiating for quite some time to try to do this kind of collaborative anti-China thing on steel, and they just can't get it done.
And why can't they get it done? Is it because Europe is bureaucratic and much less skeptical of China than the US is?
I think that's it. Europe is more divided on this kind of issue, and they just do not view China as the same level of existential, all-consuming threat. Like it is very hard to tell somebody to get into the trenches against a country that they find sort of vaguely menacing. At best, rather than existentially horrifying.
Well, I mean, this is also Europe as in the EU, right? The European Union, which is a very different view to maybe some countries individually within the European Union.
Yes, we should always caveat that. Also, like all of these things have inflation and price implications. One of the other things to remember here is that the US economy is doing really well by economic measurements. I know the vibes aren't great, but like by traditional According, if you listen to economists, the US economy is doing really, really well. Inflation's under control, unemployment's low, like GDP growth is high. The same is not true of Europe. Germany is struggling to like break half a percentage point of GDP growth. There's a bunch of countries that are sort of a little bit in trouble. Growth's not great. And there's a sense of like, well, if you suddenly, for example, slap a massive tariff on Chinese steel, steel goes into everything.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you think housing prices are high now, wait until you can't build a single thing of cement without going to a European producer rather than like, so these kind of things that I think Europe's also feels like they're less able to withstand the costs that this would impose than a US whose economy is going gangbusters.
Which brings me to the point of like, I don't know where to apportion blame, and there's probably nowhere to apportion blame, but that's no fun. But that America had a place to kind of say, do this stuff and you will get axed, like we won't put the tariffs on you. So for example, in the IRA, saying to Germany being the classic example of a country that is very heavily trying to keep China on side, join us in what we're doing against China and you will be exempt from the IRA kind of like a car built in US and Germany qualify for the subsidies. Now, obviously that has domestic political implications where Biden's going to like, yeah, but that doesn't help my Detroit factory that is going to have to vote for me. But my point is like, was there a potential space where the US could have coaxed these Europeans into a more anti-China, into a more pro-US position?
You'd both be more qualified than me to sort of speak about the presence of European companies in China and to what extent sort of the US could win effectively a bidding war for European love in terms of what the sort of consequences it can bestow and the sort of gifts it can offer. So I don't know to what extent they can do that. But the other thing is, again, as you were saying, you know, he didn't write the IRA. He had to get it through Congress and the Senate. And I think that basically meant bribing through sort of elements in this bill, dozens and dozens of House members and senators. I think it's entirely possible that, you know, maybe for him, he'd be like, oh, we can open this up and dangle some carrots in front of allies. But how do you get that kind of bill through a Senate that, you know, is really hard to get 60 votes in? Like, let's be honest.
Here's my question for you, John, right? What do you think China's going to do in retaliation? Because we've seen in the past there's been a tit-for-tat retaliation. When a tariff is slapped, China answers back. Like, what do you think China's going to do with this one? So far, they haven't done anything. That's not to say that Xi Jinping won't do something. But if you were, like, cabling back from Shanghai, what would you say?
Yeah, I think it's a good question. I think there's a couple of things. Firstly, it is absolutely in China's interest to not escalate this. They have worked very hard over the last 6 to 12 months to de-escalate trade / national security tensions with the US. I mean, if we think about sort of like late second half last year, all the talk was how Xi Jinping has overstepped with his fight with America and that he's under domestic pressure to kind of rein it back in and focus on China's economy, get the house in order at home before you take on the big dogs abroad. So I think that dynamic still exists. I think China would want to minimize this. I think domestically, China has to respond, like from a national pride response. So there's a lot of analogies between when we were talking about Iran and Israel, that Iran felt like it had to respond to the strike in Israel, but wanted to calibrate it so very carefully that it didn't escalate it because Iran didn't have any interest in escalating the problem right now. That dynamic, although it being not a war, but it's the same mentality. So I think, firstly, Dimitri can talk about this, picking out which trade tariffs to like respond with, that takes a little bit of time. You need to get your Commerce Department to kind of go, okay, here's where I think we should work and this will have this effect and that will have that effect. Then it goes to Zhong Nanhai, to the Politburo, and Xi Jinping weighs in with his advisor and they say yes, no, blah, blah, blah. They're already hosting Russia right now, so the whole system will have been focused on making sure Putin felt like his, well, I was going to say something uncouth, but making sure he feels loved. So the short answer to your question is I think China will try and find a way to respond that de-escalates or that is proportional. I think the Chinese system is currently distracted by the Putin visit. So that explains why they haven't retaliated. And it will take time to get that retaliation right. But they will. There'll be something they'll announce that says this is in response to the US. But they don't want this to get worse. They don't want to give Biden any reason or Trump any reason on the campaign trail to come out and go, China is absolutely a disgrace and we need to just ban them for everything. Like, they do not want that situation.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think I quoted Sun Tzu in today's edition, which I won't repeat, but I mean, it's a good quote.
That's very like 1800s British aristocrat of you. Like, I understand China. I read Art of War once.
Yeah, that's right. That's all you learn in business school, right, John?
Yeah, exactly. Chinese people approach everything like the Art of War. And it's like, done, analysis done, move on.
There's also something about saving face. If I remember my business school lectures, that was...
Confucius, I think,
was said that. Saving face is actually true, I will say that. Like, that is something that culturally for the Chinese is very much an integral part of how people operate.
But I've also always been like, which culture enjoys shame? Like,
probably the Brits. The Brits.
I was going to say my culture.
Correct. Yeah.
Oh, you feeling good about yourself? Absolutely not on my watch.
Not on my. Exactly. Not shaming. Shame.
I want a car. Build your dreams.
I think one of the softening things here is that most analysis suggests that these tariffs won't do anything in most of these sectors, because what's basically going to happen is a lot of them come on top of existing Trump tariffs that were pretty prohibitive. And secondly, the US, like it did before, will almost certainly start issuing waivers to any US company that's actually affected by this. Because a lot of these supply chains kind of bounce back and forth, right? So like, you know, like NVIDIA will need something that is made in a certain factory in China. You've banned imports of semiconductors and NVIDIA's like, guys, we need those. Like, and we need those tomorrow or the economy grinds to a halt. So what the US did last time was the Commerce Department issued a whole bunch of waivers to basically say these won't apply and these won't apply and these won't apply to keep certain supply chains going. So China isn't going to, like, this is more symbolic at the moment than it is kinetic commercially, and that gives China more space.
Maybe the way to sum this up too, or at least maybe this is only relevant for people who think like I do, which I guess is not that many people, but in an onus of proof, in a free market kind of globalized society, the idea is it is allowed, or it should be free trade unless we apply a very specific national or whatever the exemption is. Mm-hmm. Like it is in the legal sense, innocent until proven guilty. And maybe what this is doing is kind of saying it's guilty until proven innocent. So like, okay, it's just not banned, but there's a giant prohibitive tariff on it. And you can come to us and prove that you actually really need that little bit of thing to get through. Is that a way of framing it? It's like it's reversing the onus of proof on that stuff? Or
No, I don't even think that's it, because that would be on the substance. What's actually happening is they're opening the door for US companies to come in and go, whether this particular thing that you need is subsidized or not. If you can make the case that you can't readily get it from anywhere else and you need it to keep your factory line going, we're going to look the other way on that narrow slice on this particular stream.
The national security stuff is really a fig leaf then.
I mean, it's all kind of like this is, because it's all kind of abstract, right? Like China building electric vehicles and gaining global supremacy in electric vehicles or steel is not a national security threat in the same way that like an incoming missile is. It's more of an abstract who gets to run the future and who is well positioned to kind of dominate certain forms of power in the future, which means that on the one hand, yes, it's a fig leaf, but on the other hand, it's almost justifiable that they're like, well, there's no point like cutting our leg off to spite ourselves if this particular, like this one particular sale that you're making to us isn't going to be what makes the difference to who is running quantum computing in 2050. So we'll allow it. It's an attempt to kind of soften the blow on the US. It's an attempt to make more of the pain exclusively Chinese.
Yeah. But here's the thing, as a US consumer, as a consumer period, right? I had someone this week say to me who, you know, is very big in the climate change space, that it is better for consumers and that they want this sort of cheap EV availability in the US as a consumer, as someone who is an individual not thinking about the geopolitics and national security of this.
As in they want Chinese EVs in the US market because
they'll
be cheaper.
They just want cheaper EVs, like whatever it's going to take on a consumer level to be like, all right, cool, whatever gets me the cheapest EV that I don't have to pay for gas or petrol or whatever you guys want to call it.
I mean, but that is the argument for why governments exist though, right? It's like we probably all want, you know, all different types of things. And then the government's job is to be like, okay, yeah, but at what cost to like the national polity, as it were?
But this is the thing. So there's someone who's very, very forward-leaning and left-leaning, this particular person on the renewable space, was saying that this is actually a bad move by Biden. And this person's otherwise supportive, very supportive of the Biden administration.
Which goes back to the thing that Dimitri said before about like, you know, yes, all these trade things are bad, but is it a bad thing that solar panels are much cheaper and much more advanced than they would have otherwise been?
The fact of the matter is that where Western governments are at the moment on climate change is that they're now prepared to fight climate change, but only if they can sell it as effectively a Green New Deal jobs program. So it's we've gone from like, we don't need to have solar panels everywhere because climate change is a hoax, when we've like moved up the ladder of climate change being real, and we're now at, we need solar panels everywhere, but only as long as we get to build them.
Yeah, I mean, that's the nature of capitalism, right?
But that's not quite good enough. The problem is we need a lot more solar panels than that. And 194 countries can't be net exporters of solar panels. Like, that's not how anything works.
Last word on this. What does this do for global free liberal trade systems? Are we just putting the final nail in the coffin of the idea that there's any possible chance of a global free trade order?
I think there's an optimistic way to look at this and a pessimistic way to look at this. And the optimistic one is still bad. The pessimistic one is this is, yes, this is kind of a yet another absolute nail in the coffin. It's all going to be the Wild West from now on. Everybody's going to start interfering with trade more and more and more. There's a fantastic report by Global Trade Alert that looked at like what are the five sectors China could hit in U.S. manufacturing in swing states if it wants to cause the U.S. pain. And it's like harrowing reading. But like that's the most pessimistic read. The more optimistic read is this is still pretty narrowly contained in a handful of very sexy, very kind of politically salient sectors. So maybe we get to corral the chaos in a little walled garden asylum where there's like a free-for-all on EVs and solar panels and steel, but then everything else kind of proceeds the way things have been before with a predictable trading system. That's the more optimistic take. But
I'm going to stick with that one, Dim.
Before you jump in, I'm going to tell Dimitri to stop being a coward and choose one.
I did that already.
Which side do you fall down? Are you optimistic or are you pessimistic?
I'm actually optimistic. I think.
Okay, cool.
Short of an invasion of Taiwan, obviously, you've got a caveat.
No hedging. In foreign policy. No hedging. Optimistic. That's all.
I'm on the record. I think we're going to stay within a few target sectors.
Good.
Okay.
But I'm always wrong. So I don't know why you guys are.
And believe me, I need you to go on the record in a yes or no format. Otherwise, I'm not going to be able to come back in 3 weeks and absolutely mercilessly dump on you here.
You think the world trading order is collapsing within the next 3 weeks, John?
I'll go on the record. Yes, I do.
I'm with Jim. Look, I think that, you know, having done trade law at uni and remembering how many cases we had to learn about how just states kind of carelessly flout the international, you know, trade laws, and yet we are still standing, and yet most of the trade order is still running 85% very efficiently. I think that this is, as Dim says, just like a loud particular sector that is gaining a lot of media airtime right now, including for us. So we're perpetuating it, really.
I think it's interesting stuff, and this kind of stuff is, it's often, I think, glazed over by most people because it is, at its core, very, very tedious and legalistic and technical.
Technical.
But its impact on everybody's life and how the world is outside. So I think it's important that we talk about it and try to keep it interesting, which, Dim, I think you did a great job of keeping that at my level. So thank you for that.
Had to dumb it down.
Went above me, though, Dim.
I gave myself a concussion on the way to the podcast and just nailed
just
it.
Bashing everything you know about it out one ear so that I can fill the other ear with my nonsense. But
I just hit myself in the head with my new book out May 23rd.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yes. I mean, it's what a perfect segue before we move into lighter chat is you have a book out almost. very imminently, basically on this topic about the questions I was just asking you. So give us the plug.
Yeah, so I read a book called Why Politicians Lie About Trade and What You Need to Know About It. And it's coming out on May 23rd. It tries to explain trade kind of the way I've tried to do it on this podcast, by not talking down to you, but not assuming that you have a favorite paragraph of the GATT 1947 treaty, a beloved footnote in the anti-dumping agreement. It's six. That's the right answer, by the way. So it's out.
Where can people buy it? Are we going to put a link in the show notes, I hope?
There's a link in the show notes. Everyone is very much encouraged to pick it up. The cover's very pretty, so it'll look great on your shelves.
Excellent. Okay. I have already got my copy, by the way. Or I've at least ordered it, I should say. And I'm excited to read it in physical form. Let's move on to the final bit of the podcast. So we just chat about what we're going to be chatting about this weekend. Ideally interesting and uplifting, as if you were a guest in someone's home and trying to be charming. But I know that those instructions have in weeks past been ignored, and we've moved into being...
No, I have a good one.
Okay, you're not going to be the person who no one wants to talk to at the party, like screaming into their bourbon, Helen. So why don't you start?
Well, I finished Shogun recently, you know, the Hulu series, which was...
No spoilers. Epic. I'm on the last episode.
No spoilers. I know. It's fantastic, but it's also inspired me by a Japanese maple tree. So I went on Facebook Marketplace and now I have this 8-foot tall tree in my backyard, which I'm very proud of. And I think I'll show you photos later. But the thing I actually wanted to share was last night I went to this amazing musical called The Mummy of Evita, which is, I know it sounds whack. It was all in Spanish, but it was this incredible musical that was charting the story of Evita's body, which of course famously went missing, right? Eva Perón of Argentina went missing for 20 years after she fell. And so it was kind of after she died and then Perón fell. But it was an incredible history of Argentina and a hilarious take on sort of, you know, the geopolitics of Argentina for those who are interested. And I had never known that it was such a turbulent time in Argentina, but this mummified body of Eva Perón's was eventually returned back to Argentina in Buenos Aires, where it's now buried. So there you go. I guess that's...
And everything in Argentina has been completely fine ever since.
Correct. Yeah, yeah. Nothing to see there.
Interesting. Okay. Mine is, I've got two kind of sub-recommendations, but one, the first one is, I'm sure everyone's aware of the Rest is History podcast.
Yes.
But just generally the genre of history podcasts. We're on one now. I love them, but like, I feel like there is very few mediums more perfect for history. Like reading a book can get pretty tedious if you're reading history. If you're not interested in a bit, it's like, but history podcasts are fantastic because you have historians bringing things to life anecdotally. And if you're not interested in the topic, you just skip, but you don't have to like, you don't lose the context of the whole book, if you know what I mean. So Rest of History, I think is one of the best ones. I'm listening to one right now about George Custer, who was the Civil War era US general who died at the Battle of Little Bighorn. It's really interesting. Another one is History Hit by Dan Snow. He's a UK historian, does great stuff. So just general plug for that theme of podcast. And those are two that you can get. And then the second one is, you know, AI is kind of in vogue. Everyone's talking about it all the time. I'm still not convinced that I've found a use case I really care about. But on the history theme, I was listening to another one of my favorite podcasts who mentioned, and I'm stealing this recommendation from them unabashedly, is someone has used AI voice technology. So like, you know how you can kind of basically mimic people's voice or create voices from samples. They've reenacted I can't recall which one it was, but I think it was either the Kennedy-Nixon debate. No, that was the one that was...
Was it?
Kennedy-Nixon was televised, so it wasn't that, but it was it might've been JFK, some early presidential debates for which they had transcripts and they've got the people's, like samples of the people's voices. And they went through and kind of reimagined what that would have sounded like if you were in the room at the time, which I think is such a cool idea for using AI for like something actually that I could be like, oh, that is cool. Like imagine if you could go back and kind of hear Lincoln do the Gettysburg Address in something that sounds much more visceral than kind of reading the transcript. Like anyway, long story short, I probably should have had it up in front of me so I could talk more compellingly about it, but we'll put a link in the show notes. But the idea of using AI voice creation to bring history to life is, I think, super cool.
Dimitri.
Okay. So there's not a lot of ways to say this, but Staying on the AI theme, OpenAI has just released its latest demo and iteration of ChatGPT 4.0. Yeah. And it includes, for the first time, a voice assistant similar to the one that's on sort of all of our phones. Mm-hmm. And there is a male voice and there is a female voice. And for reasons no one can entirely pin down, they have made the female voice super flirty. Not just the voice itself, but like the way that it speaks is very like slightly tipsy college co-ed in a bar outside Georgetown. Like it is very clearly flirting with the user. And it is deeply uncomfortable to watch the demos of this because there are like OpenAI engineers demoing this and we're just all like, do you guys need a moment? Watch this on YouTube. Watch clips of this. It is just a truly this is a big company. So like boardrooms full of people. There were meetings. There were thousands of internal tests.
I'm not surprised by this at all, Dim. My brief stint in tech, you see just sort of the conversations I get, you know, I had about, from engineers and product people, and you just sort of like, does no one think about the societal impacts of all this? I mean, this is why we're where we are with social media in many senses, right? But let me just say, I'm not surprised by that at all. But it's still very interesting.
That is grim, but like, it's you have to hear it, especially because the male voice is quite normal. Yeah. The male was like, okay, I'll play Spotify for you. And the female one's like, do you come with the song?
Oh, wow. I mean, it's a topic for another day and probably not even this podcast, but, you know, the iteration a couple of months back when they released their AI that was basically written by their diversity and inclusion teams and their kind of social teams and the backlash that they got from that being like, clearly like organizational psychology. This stuff doesn't matter whether you're in government, you know, a giant multinational or a tech company. It's like people aren't very good at kind of talk. Like when you operate in silos in companies, like you make mistakes like this and you're like, how did they not pick this up in a boardroom? It's like, you know how these things happen in government. It's the same thing. Like no one thought about it because they're all in the same room and furiously in agreement with each other all the time. And in a way, it's good that they release stuff to the public so that people can be like, what the hell were you guys thinking?
Yeah. But you know, one of the famous things that actually former Google CEO was good for was actually getting two people who vastly disagreed with each other to come into the room whenever the big decisions had to be made. So it doesn't matter if like everyone
like,
is
what are we missing?
But yeah, what are we missing here? What is the counterfactual?
It's like red teaming, right?
John, yeah, exactly. If our companies don't work out, we've got a backup kick.
Exactly. Just walk into a room. What are we talking about today? I disagree.
This sucks. Start from scratch.
Training my whole life for that gig. On that note, that's a good place to wrap. Thank you very much, particularly this week to Dimitri for your actually bringing facts and learning to a podcast where Helen and I generally just tend to chat from the top of our heads.
Never again.
At least on trade. Never again. We'll see next week. Maybe it'll be my turn to be the expert on something, which I say to both of you, good luck finding what that topic is. thank you both. Dimitri, we'll see you next week. Thanks.
Thanks so much.
Helen, thank you very, very much. We'll be back next week. And until then, I don't know. Have fun. Stay safe. Whatever it is. Have a good weekend. Bye.
Dialogue editing, mixing, and mastering for this episode was done by Marissa Ewing of Hemlock Creek Productions.